8. Changing point of view. They sailed easily from the past to the present, but now they can't get back. You can change point of view, of course. It is your God-given right as an American fiction writer. All I'm saying is you need to know that you're doing it. Some American fiction writers don't. And you need to know when and how to do it, so that when you shift, you carry the reader effortlessly with you. Shifting between first and third person is enormously difficult in a short piece. Even in a novel, like example 12, this shift is uncommon and may be, in the end, unwise. Bleak House is a powerful novel, and some of its dramatic power may come from this highly artificial alternation and contrast of voices. But the transition from Dickens to Esther is always a jolt, and the 20-year-old girl sometimes begins to sound awfully like the middle-aged novelist, which is implausible, though rather a relief, because Esther is given to tiresome fits of self-deprecation, and Dickens isn't. Dickens was well aware of the dangers of his narrative strategy. The narrating author never overlaps with the observer narrator, never enters Esther's mind, never even sees her. The two narratives remain separate. The plot unites them, but they never touch. It is an odd device. So my general feeling is, if you try the first to third shift, have a really good reason for doing it, and do it with great care. Don't strip your gears. You really can't shift between detached and involved authorial voice within one piece. I don't know why you'd want to. And once again, the involved author can move from one viewpoint character to another at will. But if it happens very often, unless the writing is superbly controlled, readers will tire of being jerked from mind to mind, or will lose track of whose mind they're supposed to be in. Particularly disturbing is the effect of being jerked into a different viewpoint for a moment. With care, the involved author can do this. Tolkien does it with the fox. But it cannot be done in limited third person. If you're writing the story from Della's point of view, you can say, Della looked up into Rodney's adoring face. But you can't say, Della raised her incredibly beautiful violet eyes to Rodney's adoring face. Though Della may be well aware that her eyes are violet and beautiful, she doesn't see them when she looks up. Rodney sees them. You've shifted out of her POV into his. If Della is in fact thinking about the effect of her eyes on Rodney, you have to say so. She raised her eyes, knowing the effect their violet beauty would have on him. One-word POV shifts like that are not uncommon, but always uncomfortable. Authorial narration and limited third person have a wide overlap, since the involved author can, and usually does, use third-person narration freely, and may limit perception for some while to a single person. When the authorial voice is subtle, it can be hard to say for sure which mode a piece is written in. So, you can shift from one viewpoint character to another anytime you like, if you know why and how you're doing it, if you're cautious about doing it frequently, and if you never do it for a moment only. Exercise 8. Changing Voices. Part 1. Quick Shifts in Limited Third. A short narrative 300 to 600 words. You can use one of the sketches from Exercise 7, or make up a new scene of the same kind, several people involved in the same activity or event. Tell the story using several different viewpoint characters, narrators, in limited third person, changing from one to another as the narrative proceeds. Mark the changes with line breaks, with the narrator's name in parentheses at the head of that section, or with any device you like. I keep saying that shifting POV frequently and without notice is risky, dangerous. So you want to do something dangerous. Part 2. Thin ice. In 300 to 1,000 words, tell the same story, or a new story of the same kind, deliberately shifting POV from character to character several times without any obvious signal to the reader that you're doing so. You can, of course, do part 2 merely by removing the signals from part 1, but you won't learn much by doing so. Thin ice calls for a different narrative technique and possibly a different narrative. I think it is likely to end up being written by the involved author, even though you are apparently using only limited third-person viewpoint. This ice really is thin, and the waters are deep. A model of this kind of POV shifting is example 14 from To the Lighthouse. Example 14. Virginia Woolf from To the Lighthouse. What brought her to say that? We are in the hands of the Lord, she wondered. The insincerity slipping in among the truths roused her, annoyed her. She returned to her knitting again. How could any Lord have made this world? She asked. With her mind, she had always seized the fact that there is no reason, order, justice, but suffering, death, the poor. There was no treachery too base for the world to commit. She knew that. No happiness lasted. She knew that. She knitted with firm composure, slightly pursing her lips and, without being aware of it, so stiffened and composed the lines of her face in a habit of sternness that, when her husband passed, though he was chuckling at the thought that Hume, the philosopher, grown enormously fat, had stuck in a bog, he could not help noting, as he passed, the sternness at the heart of her beauty. It saddened him, and her remoteness pained him, and he felt, as he passed, that he could not protect her. And when he reached the hedge, he was sad. He could do nothing to help her. He must stand by and watch her. Indeed, the infernal truth was, he made things worse for her. He was irritable, he was touchy. He had lost his temper over the lighthouse. He looked into the hedge, into its intricacy, its darkness. Always, Mrs. Ramsay felt, one helped oneself out of solitude, reluctantly, by laying hold of some little odd or end, some sound, some sight. She listened. But it was all very still. Cricket was over. The children were in their baths. There was only the sound of the sea. She stopped knitting. She held the long reddish-brown stocking dangling in her hands a moment. She saw the light again. With some irony in her interrogation, for when one woke at all, one's relations changed, she looked at the steady light, the pitiless, the remorseless, which was so much her, yet so little her, which had her, at its beck and call. She woke in the night and saw it bent across their bed, stroking the floor. But for all that she thought, watching it with fascination, hypnotized, as if it were stroking with its silver fingers some sealed vessel in her brain whose bursting would flood her with delight, she had known happiness, exquisite happiness, intense happiness, and it silvered the rough waves a little more brightly as daylight faded and the blue went out of the sea, and it rolled in waves of pure lemon which curved and swelled and broke upon the beach, and the ecstasy burst in her eyes, and waves of pure delight raced over the floor of her mind, and she felt, "It is enough! It is enough!" He turned and saw her. Ah, she was lovely, lovelier now than ever, he thought. But he could not speak to her. He could not interrupt her. He wanted urgently to speak to her, now that James was gone and she was alone at last. But he resolved, no, he would not interrupt her. She was aloof from him now in her beauty, in her sadness. He would let her be. And he passed her without a word, though it hurt him that she should look so distant, and he could not reach her. He could do nothing to help her. And again, he would have passed her without a word had she not, at that very moment, given him of her own free will what she knew he would never ask, and called to him, and taken the green shawl off the picture frame, and gone to him. For he wished, she knew, to protect her. Notice how Wolfe makes the transitions effortlessly, but perfectly clearly, from "What brought her to say that?" to the second "She knew that." We are in Mrs. Ramsay's POV. Then we slip out of it, the signal being that we can see Mrs. Ramsay slightly pursing her lips, composing her face, in a habit of sternness, which Mr. Ramsay, passing, chuckling at the thought of a philosopher stuck in a bog, sees from his POV. And he grows sad, feeling that he cannot protect her. The paragraph indent is the signal for the switch back to Mrs. Ramsay. What are the next switches, and how are they signaled? A reminder about imitation. A rational fear of plagiarizing and an individualistic valuation of originality have stopped many prose writers from using deliberate imitation as a learning tool. In poetry courses, students may be asked to write in the manner of so-and-so, or to use a stanza or a cadence from a published poet as a model. But teachers of prose writing seem to shun the very idea of imitating. I think conscious, deliberate imitation of a piece of prose one admires can be good training, a means toward finding one's own voice as a narrative writer. If you want to imitate any of the examples in this book, or anything else, do so. What is essential is the consciousness. When imitating, it's necessary to remember that the work, however successful, is practice, not an end in itself, but a means toward the end of writing with skill and freedom in one's own voice. In critiquing these exercises, you might talk about how well the shifts work, what's gained or lost by them, how the piece might have differed if told from one POV only. For a while afterward, when reading fiction, you might take a moment to consider what POV is being used, who the viewpoint character is, when the POV shifts, and so on. It's interesting to see how different writers do it, and you can learn a great deal from watching great artists of narrative technique, such as Wolfe and Atwood.